Most people get a podcast. You know why? They can't get a job on a regular radio station.
Dan Long,
the best in the business.
Sit right down, relax, open your ears real wide and say...
All the skeptics and all the people have a little bit of... Let me do this again.
Oh, it's live, pal.
Sorry.
That's right, we are live, pal. 720 WGN, WGNradio.com. Dan Long reporting from Studio B on the 7th floor of the Tribune Tower overlooking Michigan Avenue in Chicago. And it's an honor for me to welcome my guest today, WWE Hall of Fame broadcaster. He's the voice. He's good old JR, Jim Ross.
Glad to be here, man. We picked a beautiful day to be in Chicago, didn't we?
Yeah, you got here just in time for the weather to take a dive.
I can tell you where my underwear stops. My legs, it's cold. I'm an Okie, man. I came from southern warm weather, and it's a little startling this morning, but hey, it's always fun to be here.
Well, you were in Connecticut, too, for how many years? That's no treat fall and winter.
I think I referred to Connecticut one time on television as a hellhole. whatever a hellhole is, that's what they is.
And Jim is in town today, Tuesday, October 24th, and tomorrow, Wednesday, October 25th. He's got two book signings going on for his new book, Slobberknocker, My Life in Wrestling. It's a memoir that I think a lot of wrestling fans have been waiting for. So tonight, in a matter of hours, 7 p.m., Barnes & Noble at the Old Orchard Mall in Skokie, 55 Old Orchard Center. Get your book signed, talk to JR. And tomorrow, at the brand new Pro Wrestling Tees retail store, they finally got a brick-and-mortar thing going on. And that'll be at 6 p.m. That's 2348 North Damon Avenue, and that's in the city. The tagline for this book, JR, is the wrestling book you've been waiting for, and I think that's true for a lot of people.
Well, it's, Dan's doing well. I'm really blessed. You know, it was challenging to get to this part of the journey with the book. You know, I really decided to when the WWE and I split the sheets, as they say, in 2013 in September. I'm going from the Stanford back to LaGuardia, trying to figure out, okay, what am I going to do next? You know, retire, which was suggested, or reinvent. And by the time I got to LaGuardia and got on my little American Airlines flight back home, I had reinvented. We're going to reinvent. And one of the things I want to do is write a book. You know, I helped write Stone Cold Steve Austin's book. I wrote a cookbook with my wife, Jan, and Dennis Brent, two New York Times bestsellers. So my wife was really involved in this project. I got a good writing partner, Scott Williams, and everything was smoothly rolling along pretty smoothly. And then Scott suddenly passes away with no warning. A poor guy had a heart attack and just died, boom, on the spot. So then I had Paul O'Brien working with us, and he's in Ireland. You can't get there from here, from Oklahoma type deal, right?
It's got to be a tough two-way working situation.
It was challenging, but we made it work. And then in March, my wife got killed in a vehicle accident, and I almost decided, man, what the hell, man? This is just, book is jinxed. I lost my writing partner, lost my life partner all along this journey, but I decided, you know, my old man told me one time, he said, let me tell you something, I take this with me, and I thought about it. I pulled it out, and I hadn't thought about it in years. He said that quitting is the easiest thing in the world to get good at, and that was when I was going to quit my ninth grade football team and just found the varsity because I was a big star at 15, right? So that didn't happen. But nonetheless, quitting is the easiest thing in the world to get good at. And I remembered that, and we finished the book, and I'm really glad that we did because my wife had such a large part of my career and in this book. She has a big role in this book.
Yeah, and she does. And the recurring theme, I think, it ties in with what you were just talking about, is you kind of repeatedly overcoming adversity. I mean, the book is framed around the main event of WrestleMania 15, which was 99, the first Stone Cold and The Rock match. And you had just gotten back from a bout with Bell's palsy. Where did the decision come from to make that your framing device?
How we structured the book, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, Paul O'Brien and I strategized over the book, but I will give Paul more credit than I would ever be willing to accept. We knew where the book was going to end. What we did and what Paul did was come up with an idea to where the first chapter of the book is the locker room, and I'm having a panic attack for real, like Tony Soprano, like panic attack, you know. And Rock and Austin, two guys I'd signed, two guys I was, you know, managing in the talent relations department, had gone to Vince McMahon, and they, the three of them, had collaborated and said, well, it's a good time to bring OJR back for one match. My mother had died in December. I'd been out with Bell's palsy all those months. I thought my career was really over, and I thought that day would probably be it. And but Paul came up with a little creative thing to start the book in 99 in that Philadelphia arena and end the book in 99 that Philadelphia arena. But in the middle, there's a lot of stuff, man.
Absolutely. And it's jam-packed with story after story, and it's every, like, big name in the wrestling business that you want to think of. The first big name that popped to me was obviously Cowboy Bill Watts. Would you say he was kind of the formative figure for you in early part of your career?
Without a doubt. He was my Vince Lombardi. I feel like, you know, if I was one of the old Packers, you know, he was my Vince Lombardi. He taught me the game, and sometimes in a very coarse, abrupt way. But see, the beautiful part about me being in the wrestling business and working for domineering, strong alpha males is that's who raised me, a domineering, strong alpha male. Remember, son. Quitting's the easiest thing in the world to get good at. So he was just old John Wayne kind of guy. But Watts was my before my foundation of my philosophies and how I value fundamentals, he was really special.
What was the, if you had to kind of pick one thing, like the most important lesson you learned from working with Watts in kind of the Mid-South portion of your career, what did you learn the most about the business?
Approach the business as if it was a mainstream, real sport. Put yourself in that mindset, in other words, as a soundtrack guy, as a narrative guy, keep in that world and don't step over into the showbiz world too prominently, because you're going to alienate your hardcore fans if you start insulting their intelligence. So stick with a more sports-oriented approach and consider what you're seeing and you're calling real. It is simulated fighting. Pro wrestling is simulated combat sport. There is physicality. There are injuries, as we all know. It's obvious, but there's nothing fake about how to get to the finish. But the finish is we all know is been predetermined. But the bottom line for Watts was be real, and we're going to do a real product. My talents are going to give you a product that you can call under this guise. And live with that. And I have for all my career.
The thing that stands out to me about your commentary is you are so good at building moments and making them sound important. One of the first matches I can remember, obviously one that I think you're asked about all the time, is the Mick Foley Undertaker Hell in a Cell match. I prepped for this interview, and it was an excuse for me to kind of go back and revisit a lot of that stuff.
Good.
But just the way, even before the match started, the Undertaker climbing the cage, and we just said, okay, Mankind wants to go up, the Undertaker is going to go up. These two men are about to endure something like pain that you cannot imagine. And the way that you made what on its surface is ridiculous, you made it sound like the biggest thing in the world.
Well, thanks. Here's the deal. I've always been a fan of the genre. But before I was a fan of pro wrestling, and to that degree, I was a big fan of broadcasting. In my little transistor radio, I grew up with Harry Carey and Jack Buck, KMOX Radio in St. Louis, back in the day. And all those great storytellers who were able to go on radio, which is my favorite medium, by the way, because I do love the theater of the mind, and that's what those guys did. I could listen to Harry Carey tell me, I knew exactly how blue the sky was in St. Louis on a Sunday afternoon for the first game of two with the Chicago Cubs. Boom. Easy. Great. And he gave you the feel good, and he knew who he was. There's a, you know, it's just great. So that was my thing with those guys. I never thought wrestling would be my destination, but I wanted broadcasting to be my destination.
But yet it sounds like the way you wrote, you always had passion for wrestling from an early age.
Yep, I did. It's like, I tell you, it's like, and I understand a lot of bullying. I think a lot of wrestling fans get verbally bullied because, you know, how many guys are listening right now have heard this? Oh, man. You're a fan of wrestling? You watch wrestling? You watch that stuff? Come on.
You know it's fake, right?
Oh, yeah. You know it's fake, right? You know it's fake, right? So, yeah, I knew John Wayne wasn't a cowboy, but I sure liked his movies. you know. He also wasn't a Marine. But you know, so why let the facts get revealed? Good story. The point is that we've all experienced that. And I certainly did. And so you become kind of a closet wrestling fan because you get tired of the consternation that you're faced with from your peers or your family. That's even worse. What was worse for me was my dad did not like it because he felt it was insulting that they were trying to perpetrate a showbiz entity as a legitimate sport.
Okay.
That's my dad's deal. So I said, okay. So anyhow, but here, I had stipulations to watch that 1 hour of wrestling every week. As a young kid, the only child, 160-acre farm, I had plenty to do. If I got my chores done, this is no kidding, and my grades are good, I feel like I was trying to get, you know, D1 academic eligibility to play for, you know, the Oklahoma Sooners or something. But if my grades were good and I got my chores done, I got to watch 1 hour of wrestling a week, the 1 hour it was on. And my mom knew how important it was to me, and the old man just made it a little challenging to get that because he wasn't going to shut me down to watch 1 hour of wrestling, but he wanted me to earn the right to do it. And I kind of got that as I got older.
We'll get to the Attitude Era a little bit here, just because that was how I got into it. You know, I was aware of, obviously, you know, the stuff that came before Hogan and Savage and Flair, but you were the voice of wrestling for me and a lot of people my age. During the Monday Night Wars, in the moment, as this whole thing with WCW kind of unfolded and Vince decided to go edgy, did you realize how hot it was going to be? Did you realize that this was when wrestling was going to be at its most mainstream?
No, I'd like to tell you, Dan, I got this great intellect. I'm a whole hell of a lot smarter than I look, thank God. No, I knew it was a very unique time in the history of the pro wrestling business on television. You know, when you go back to the Dumont Network and at the Chicago Amphitheater,
sure,
back in the day again, you know, this old crazy genre has a hell of a footprint, man, a great history. And some of us respect that history, and the athletes and the promoters and the fans that help perpetuate it. Because now it's a big business. But I never dreamed it would be like it, you know, got like it was. But I was very lucky that I have been timing's a lot of good stuff here, man. I was along when we went from syndication and local TV over the air stations, then this new thing called cable TV that a lot of people didn't think would stick around. That came about, and so we got involved in that. Then we got then this other deal. Hey, sure as hell ain't gonna make it. That's that satellite stuff. That ain't gonna make it. So and all the pay per view was a new innovation, you know. And then now social media is. I'm still around. I've seen so many changes in the business. It's been amazing. But to say I thought wrestling would be where it is, I think right now pro wrestling is probably more popular, seen by more people, and more people in it make a living, which is good for us Americans, that our peers have a job and they're making a living.
Sure.
That's a good thing. It doesn't matter. Well, yeah, but they're doing that damn wrestling. You know it's fake, don't you? Well, the money ain't. My banker don't ask, you know, I used to tell guys that your banker will never ask you if you won or lost last week. He's just going to work the check.
With WWF and WCW, you had two mainstream competitors with cable TV deals. Now it's a little more fragmented. There's a lot of indies and, you know, Americans have always been going over to Japan, but now U.S. audiences have regular access to that. Do you think the business is better off the way it is now, or would you like to see the rise of a second major U.S. promotion?
Well, hey, look, the strong survive in this world in that regard. There's nothing holding a second promotion from being big. You know, I've always thought that Ring of Honor had the opportunity to get a lot bigger if they chose to invest in their wrestling product based on their huge syndicated network and the fact that they're in negotiations to buy WGN.
Yes, Sinclair Media.
So with that said, that can give you a much bigger footprint for your product. But I don't know where they want to go with their wrestling product. It's a big commitment to do that. You got to expand your roster. You got to spend your infrastructure costs increase, and you got to manage more. Having an HR department for wrestlers is a hell of a job. Man, that's kind of what talent relations was. You know, we hired them, we negotiated with them, we trained them, we helped manage the drug program. But man, at the end of the day, you're a kind of a Dr. Phil and a whatever. They're athletes that I think a lot of guys, I was talking about this the other day to somebody. One of the reasons that wrestlers, I think, act out sometimes on the road, and sometimes they have discipline problems, I think there's a lot of inherent guilt that they're not home. They're missing Johnny's ball game. They're missing Sally's recital.
Right.
They missed a wife, Susie's anniversary. And so I think a lot of guys come on the road that are troubled, and that's one of the things I think we did a nice job of. Our team did a nice job in WWE at that time of listening, and not doing it by text.
Right.
Not doing it by FaceTime. Sitting across to somebody and listening. It works more often than not.
Yeah, I think you described it as you're a priest, a guidance counselor, a 12-step sponsor, a school principal. Going back to you being the head of talent relations, what was it, 96 to like 06-ish for WWE, that time period?
Yeah, something like that.
Okay. And so you were at the Attitude Era roster, I think, is maybe the deepest roster the company ever had. That was your doing for the most part. Did Vince pretty much gave you the reins and said, you know, hire who you want and then we'll take it from there, right?
Pretty much. You know, he was certainly always involved. I kept him informed. You're going to keep the most powerful man in your business informed. Because I was a direct report.
Right.
So he didn't have many direct reports. I think he had maybe four. Kevin Dunn and I were both direct reports, Kevin in television, me in talent. So I kept him informed, but he basically used my judgment and the feedback I got from our staff that scouted and the guys I'd met. And we went through a good process with this deal. We met people. We got to know guys. I used more old-school college football recruiting technique or maybe NFL free agent draft recruiting to tell them why they should be here or why they should sign this contract to give this an opportunity, because that's what it is, a great opportunity. And, you know, we had one class that had it had Lesnar, Brock Lesnar, John Cena, Dave Bautista, Randy Orton, and Shelton Benjamin in one class. Now, I say that because that credit goes to a lot of people involved in recruiting. Jerry Briscoe recruited Brock Lesnar and Shelton Benjamin for 2 years. But we had a plan. And Jerry's college teammate was the head coach at Minnesota, where Brock and Shelton wrestled. I got me an in. Now, we get embedded, and we're there. And we all knew that Lesnar had the aptitude and he set his powerful ego aside of being a man's man, where every now and then you got to sell for the other guy, and, you know, in pro wrestling. If he could do that, he was a cash cow, and he has been he's a cash bull.
Yeah. Some of the guys you recruited, one of those guys was The Rock, and you mentioned you knew he was a blue chipper from the second you sat down and had lunch with him. And obviously The Rock is different from a Brock Lesnar, who's different from a Mick Foley, who's different from a Stone Cold. But is there any set of traits that you specifically look for in these guys who all have something different to offer? Is there anything in common that sort of lets you know, okay, this guy gets it, he has it, he's going
to
make it?
I always wanted to have the commitment, Dan, when I got through talking to somebody, the commitment. I wanted to have the feeling, a good feeling, that the individual I just spoke with, this recruit, so to speak, will keep his commitment, will be have the best trait that I can get for my company and for our locker room, and that is reliability. Because, you know, if you're not reliable, all this, it's like the NFL. You run a 4-3, you don't make a damn if you're not going to show up, or you're going to flunk a test, or you're going to have some issues. If I can't rely on you, what good are you to me? That sounds cold and callous, but really, that's kind of life, man. If I can't rely on you, then I can't do business with you.
Yeah.
No ill will here. Just I can't do business with you if I can't rely on you. And I just felt like Dwayne was so hell-bent in a quiet yet very confident way that he was going to be a big star. I think he always had this premonition in his heart that he was going to be a big star at something. And it might have been at one time to be a big star singing country music, believe it or not.
Is that true?
Oh, yeah, he loves it. He's a connoisseur of classic country. But he had that vision of his success. He visualized it and made it happen, quite frankly. But he told me at that first meeting, he said, I just want you to sign our deal. I just want you to know one thing. I was Jim then. I mean, one thing, Jim, I'm going to be your top guy. Now, we had a lot of guys that was already in line. You know, we had a guy named Austin was there, and Undertaker was there, Triple H, Shawn Michaels. A lot of good guys, obviously. And I didn't dissuade him. You don't ever dissuade somebody from wanting to be successful. No, you don't want to be that successful now. No, hold it back now. I don't need that. I don't need your best effort.
Right, you can't have guys holding back purposely.
No. So, anyway, I said, that's a great goal. Never change. Always want to, whatever you're doing, I want to be the top guy. Why not? Somebody's going to be the top guy. Why not you? And that's kind of how I kind of looked at my career. God almighty, Dan, here you and I sit here. I never had, not today or any time, I've never had the perfect face for television. I've had this crazy Oklahoma accent. Then I get nailed with three bouts of Bell's palsy, so I got to learn to speak. Some of my speech impediments are more pronounced at this stage of my life than ever because of my Bell's palsy remnants. And I have to concentrate on enunciating. It's not easy. I can sound like a Mel Brooks very easily and be, JR's drinking again. Well, I might be drinking. I'll let you know when it is. But sometimes it's fatigue. But in any event, I think that you always have to have that thing in your heart where I'm going to be the top guy, especially in the paranoid world of pro wrestling. I don't think it's probably any different than the NFL or the NBA or anywhere else. Once you kind of get in it, you kind of realize that you're in a very elite group, rare air, and it could end at any time, one bad injury. One bad whatever, you're done.
You got to cash in while you can.
You better cash, baby. You better cash it in because shelf life could be very fleeting. So wrestlers then see that as even – because they're doing their own stunts. They don't have – there's no cut. Okay, double, get in here. There's none of that. So I think there's an innate paranoia of that about injuries. And you see it, every good football movie ever made has scenes in it where players are worried about their own mortality, professional mortality. They're willing to take drugs, they're willing to take shots, they're willing to do whatever to play another year, get that one more deal, whatever. So it's the same thing here in this art form of wrestling.
In our business, being broadcasting, one of the things we struggle with is finding your own singular voice. And you mentioned in the book that at first, when you first came back to WWE and Vince was going to, you were going to do commentary with Vince and Jerry Lawler a little bit, you weren't crazy about the good old JR, you know, black hat wearing persona, but the work you did in that persona ended up being your most prolific. What was it like trying to find your voice under those circumstances?
It was largely a timing thing, Dan. You have your play-by-play guy is normally your lead guy. So he's going to get you back on the air and get you off the air. He's the point guard. He speaks first, in other words. Then you have Lawler there, who's, you know, the incumbent and as good as there is at it. And so then I became the third guy. Well, I had never been the third guy before. So it was not a matter of my ego, it was to some degree. I'll be fully transparent. You know, I am a lead guy. You know, I don't do short relief. I'm a starter. You know, come on. But, you know, settle down, JR. You'll be all right. But I thought that once we kind of found our legs and our timing, our voice, that trio was pretty good.
You worked with some great color guys, too. The aforementioned Jerry the King Lawler. You called, was it WrestleMania 94? I'm struggling with my Roman numerals, but you called it with Bobby the Brain Heenan. And obviously Paul Heyman during the invasion angle. How did you have to adjust your own game and play into what their strengths were?
They would have refused for me to change my game because they were prepared to interface with me based on my predictability. I'd like to think I'm consistent. My pace, my timing, I'm getting in here, I'm laying out there. You know, it's like finding your groove. It's like hearing music, and you kind of get in that timing thing. Because everything's moving, all these moving parts. You know, as I said, I think the guys, the talents in a ring do this, Dan. They make music. And announcers like me and others provide lyrics. You hope that the combination of their music, which comes first, and your lyric, which is second, is a pleasing presentation that people want to hear again or see again in this essence. So the point is that it all starts with the talent, but I always state basically what I do, but Lawler, Heenan, and Heyman, you know, you ain't got to be that good to work with them. I mean, they're really good, man. And so you become that point guard. You set them up. You don't rehearse nothing. All three of those guys, well, first of all, Lawler and Heenan would have refused to rehearse. They ain't going to happen. So stop. Don't waste your time. If Heyman and I would have done too much rehearsing, would have had another eruption that wasn't even on camera because he's easy to dislike.
Are you talking on screen or
personally? Well, as a character. He gets so wrapped up in he gets in the character. And sometimes you're not prepared for Paul E.
Right.
I thought I was talking to Paul Heyman. No. Paul E's here now. Okay, good. Paul E's here. He's brilliant. And he and I had a great year. We had a good run in WCW. When, as I said in my book, the booking committee wouldn't have nothing to do with Paul Heyman. Nothing. They didn't want to work with him. And so I took them off at their hands and made me better. So their loss was my gain, and a broadcaster and a real national talking star was born when we put Paul together with me on TBS because he got tremendous exposure. He was in every segment.
And then down the road, he ended up being an asset as a booker in ECW and later on for WWE for a little while too.
Yeah, and he's right now the best talker in the business, I think.
Absolutely.
He makes better points. And you know, the beautiful part about Paul is, you know, I had on my podcast this week, I have Rory Karp. Rory Karp is the Emmy Award-winning director of the Ric Flair documentary, 30 for 30.
Yeah, that's coming up soon.
November 7th on ESPN. And he did the Christian Laettner 30 for 30.
Yeah, I Hate Christian Laettner. Yeah.
And the Manning one, the House of Manning or something like that.
Yeah.
And Dale, the movie. My point is, Rory Karp is a big-time director, and he's on my podcast this week. And we were talking about one of Ric Flair's promos, and Rory said, I saw hundreds and hundreds of his promos. 2 years of putting this thing together. Hundreds. He said, it's amazing how good he is. Talking about Flair. You're preaching the choir with me because I know how good he is. But here's what I didn't ever put in this context, and Roy did it from a television perspective. All those interviews Flair did that killed it, those hundreds of passionate or funny or angry or whatever interviews that you listened to and you remembered were ad-libs. None were structured. None were written. There was no prompter. There's nobody giving you cue cards. No nothing. It's his creativity, with maybe a little input from the booker about what we're going to, you know, what the build
bullet up, points to hit.
Bullet points, yeah. Who, what, when, and where, right? And after you get the who, what, when, and where in your promo, wherever you want for 2 minutes or whatever. So you gave the talents, these creative guys, this artistic freedom just to roll. And I think now even the smaller promotions on television are more structured with their promos, with their talents. And I think that's a mistake because you suppress organic material that way, and I think us wrestling fans like reality based. Again, it goes back to the watch thing. Approach it like it's real, JR. It's a real fight now, so you got to approach it that way. So I don't see enough of that.
Let's talk about Vince McMahon for a second and what your relationship is like now. Because since the time where the book stops, obviously a lot's happened in your career. You were honored by the Hall of Fame and then in and out of the WWE at various points. And then even when you were on screen, kind of put in some less than ideal situations. But there's also a guy with a heart there that comes across in the book. You talk about a handwritten letter he writes you at some point, and he had encouraging words for guys who worked for him who were struggling too. So what's your relationship and your take on Vince now at this point in both your lives?
I think that my relationship with Vince is probably one of the more misidentified and misinterpreted relationships. People have to understand that, you know, we have two relationships, Vince and I. We have a business relationship and we have a personal relationship. We stopped doing business together in 2013, but we never stopped communicating and we never stopped being friends. I knew that, and I mean this sincerely, during that time of my exile, if I had needed something, Dan, if I said, Vince, I got to have X, I could tell you without any BS, I get it. So that's the friend side of Vince, but he's still a tough-ass businessman. He's the hardest-working guy I've ever been around. But again, you know, growing up with old J.D. Ross in eastern Oklahoma got me ready for Vince McMahon, no problem. I got along with him because I knew he was the alpha male, and I had no problem respecting and dealing with that. But I learned more from him than anybody, him and Bill. And it's really cool. I had Cowboy at the very beginning of my career. I got Vince McMahon at the very end of my career. So my bookends and my run in the business are Watts and McMahon. I think I got pretty good heritage. I got pretty good DNA right here.
No doubt.
You know, lucky for me. I mean, I'm bragging about me. I was lucky. Right place, right time. These guys. And I got to work with these guys. And I got given responsibility. I got joined at the hip with them. I learned a lot. So Vince taught me so much. And, you know, he was very aggressive and forthcoming on me coming back. And my wife, Jan, God bless her, wanted me to go home, as she said, back on the team, our team. And, you know, she didn't make it to WrestleMania, but I was there. And, you know, I had no idea that I was going to do the last match. That was a Vince McMahon call, period. JR's coming back. By God, he's going to call the main event. Pretty cool for me. So, look, have we always always agreed? No. Heck no. Have we argued? Absolutely. Absolutely we've argued. I'm no different than somebody arguing with a head coach about a play you want to call. I want to go for it on fourth down. No, we're going to punt. No, damn it. I want to go for it. There's no argument here. We're punting. So that's what you do. So that's kind of the deal with Vince. We've had arguments, but you know, the older we get, you know, it's not, you know, we look at things differently. And the year I've had with losing my wife, I kind of look at things a little differently. And, you know, boy, there's things that used to be big deals, Dan, aren't such a big deal anymore,
sure,
quite frankly. But I value my friendship with Vince, and I value the fact that we're growing old together. And I value the fact that he'll always be there for me if I need something. Now, luckily for me, just like he told me back in the mid-90s when I took a huge pay cut because we were really hurting, bleeding money, that if I stayed with him, he'd take care of me. And he did. So when I left in 2013, that's what I'm saying. It's either retire or reinvent. I could have retired. I had the money to retire. And do what? Hell, I got the life of Riley as it is. I'm sitting here talking to you. I'm going to sign some books, you know, in Skokie tonight. And I'm going to sign books at Pro Wrestling Tees on Wednesday night. I'm going to be around fans, people that like me and I like them. How bad can that be? And if I retired, I'd miss all this. So I'm not going to retire. And then I'm going to get back to Oklahoma on Friday and go to my football game on Saturday night. And we play the Texas Tech Red Raiders come to our stadium. So I got a good life. It's just we all get knocked down. It's like you said, you hit it around the head, Dan. I have been knocked down a lot. I've had a lot of challenges. It's up to us, man. Get your ass up or stay down. And, boy, that view from down there ain't so good.
Well said. Let me hit you with a couple quick things here, and then I know you guys got a busy day. I'll cut you guys loose. Just staying active, getting back at the broadcast table. You did some stuff with NXT, with access for the American feed of New Japan. You did the Mae Young Classic. What's it like kind of getting back in the saddle?
It's fun. Last week I did six shows in voiceover for Access TV. They're a presentation of New Japan Pro Wrestling airs on Access TV, which, by the way, for those that may not be familiar with that Mark Cuban's network, it used to be called HDNet.
Yeah, I just found that out when I was doing some research.
Yeah, so it's I watch it on DirecTV. It's on channel 340 on DirecTV if you're into that carrier. But I do a show with Josh Barnett on there from Friday night. So I go out to L.A. about, I don't know, every 4 or 5 weeks, do 4 to 6, 7 shows at a setting. And I love it because it's the American announcers, whether it be in WWE or Ring of Honor or wherever, Impact, I don't care where it is, they serve a lot of masters. And that's not a negative term. They have a lot of things they must address within their broadcast. It could be what's coming up next week, a live event, a pay-per-view, a movie premiere, Twitter, hashtag this, what's trending, da-da-da, Facebook, I mean, everything. When we do our show, we are told, don't billboard next week. Don't billboard what happened last week. We're not promoting any live events. We don't have any pay-per-views. You guys are to call the match like it's a sporting event. And I'm thinking, ding, 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 ding. It's Bill Watts. Is Bill Watts here? You know, right? So when I go do this voiceovers, Dan, they count us in, and they'll count us out. But they never say a thing in the match. They leave it up to us to create our own story based on what we're seeing. Based on the music we hear, we provide the lyric that applies to it. like we talked about earlier. So I love doing it, and it looks like there's a good chance right now, at least I'm knock on wood, I don't want to jinx this deal, but it looks like we're going to be able to continue that another year after this contract's up, which is going to be at the end of this year. So I'm glad that that's another Vince deal. WWE acquired my rights, and based on this contract with Access ending this year. But, we talked about it, and they thought, well, it gives JR something to do, keeps his skills sharp, he's working regularly, nice payday. How's it hurting us? So I think that's going to work out. So if that's the case, then in 2018 I'll be doing whatever my WWE assignments are, whatever they may be. And I know that they're talking to me about doing a UK show for the network if they put all the pieces together. That's been on their radar for a long time.
Yeah.
That's not a secret. Our new news, unfortunately. I can give you a scoop. I don't have one. But if they do, that's a big deal. If they do a UK weekly show, I think Nigel McGuinness and I are going to do that. So that could be another project. It could be more regular stuff. But I'm staying about as busy as I need to be. And I really want to promote this book good. You know, we're already in our third printing, and it's only been out 2 weeks. It's Found a Heartbeat, Dan.
Yeah, I noticed it was sold out on Amazon when I tried to buy it. So
really?
I got it on Kindle.
Wow.
It's really good read. And if you're a fan of the business, obviously it's a must read. But it's also, you know, if you just want a story told, about a guy who just keeps coming back for more, it's Jim Ross. One last thing before you go. Did you talk to, he had a great career here for Lovie Smith's defenses, Tommy Harris. Uh-huh. Did he mention something about being interested in getting in the ring to you?
Yeah, Tommy's doing a lot of charity work. And gosh, if you didn't know Tommy, you wouldn't even recognize him because he's about 225, 230. He looks great. But he's a 300-pounder.
Yeah.
D tackle.
Yeah.
He came here with Dusty Dvorak.
Yes.
The two big Oklahoma defensive tackles ended up here in Chicago. Tommy said that he was going to do a tryout with WWE. I don't know, Dan, if it's really an official tryout, because he's 32 or 33, I think, something like that.
Yeah, I think mid-30s.
Yeah, something. And so that's a little bit late, long in the tooth, as they say, to start a new wrestling career. Now, he's a magnificent athlete. Maybe he's a natural. Who knows? I don't know. But I think maybe it may be something to do with some charity, a charity or some charities that he's working with to create some awareness for his projects.
Okay.
So I'm not sure it's a 100% bona fide, I want to try to get a job in WWE, or I want to help build my charity, and WWE's looking at as an opportunity for some nice television programming with a big-time former player. Tommy was a big player, you know. He just had a short run.
Yeah.
Injuries and stuff.
But, same thing that gets a lot of guys. Yeah. Just
Dusty.
Can't stay healthy. Yeah.
Dusty's the same way. But Dusty's landed on his feet. He's doing ESPN football on Friday nights, and he's doing a radio show in Oklahoma City. So he's got his broadcast career's doing well.
The book, Slobberknocker, My Life in Wrestling, Jim Ross. Go see him tonight in a matter of hours. It's Tuesday, October 24th, tonight, 7 p.m., Barnes & Noble at the Old Orchard Mall, 55 Old Orchard Center up in Skokie. Tomorrow, Wednesday, October 25th, 6 p.m. at the new Pro Wrestling Tees retail store, 2348 North Damon Avenue. Follow him at JR's Barbecue on Twitter. That's JR'sBarbecue.com. Read the blog. You can access the Ross Report podcast from there. And Jim Ross, I got to say, I hope this was good for you. Honestly, it was a thrill for me getting you up here.
It was so good, Dan. I just want to smoke.
That's what I'm going to go do downstairs right now. That was Jim Ross. I'm Dan Long. This is 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com.